Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and macabre murders from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's an episode!
Yes, it is.
It's an episode.
We have no idea what number it is.
We always forget what number it is. Well, after 100. It's just paled
it's
into
just
a
another episode.
Sea of numbers. But yes, it's 108.
Oh, so you do know what episode it was.
Yes.
It was all a jolly jape, was it? All of that?
Yes, it was a ruse.
Fill in some extra time.
Pretty much, this is what this whole episode is. It's me padding about numbers. Ah, 108. How are you, Nick?
I'm fine.
You're good, you're happy, you're quaffing, you're a pre-cocktail cocktail.
I'm pre-cocktail cocktail cocktail cocktail.
You've got a big plan for the night,
absolutely.
I see.
Absolutely, yeah. I've got plans. It's going to be exciting.
Very good. What is the pre-cocktail cocktail?
It is a Negroni. It has to be. It's generally usually is a Negroni.
Gets you in the zone.
Yeah, it does. And I should put the pen down that clicks.
Yes, I'll hear that through editing.
Otherwise, I should be murdered halfway through the episode.
With the pen.
With the pen, yeah.
I read any poisonings this week?
Well, you, by the sounds of you.
Only a slight cold. I mean, if I laugh really heavily, I will go into a coughing fit.
Oh, good.
Yes. But
perfect for recording.
Absolutely fine. It's no problem whatsoever. If I sound a bit nasal, it's just because everything's congealed.
That's a delight.
Isn't it? I like to bring it.
You also good. Brought it to my house, whatever this plague is that you're carrying.
I offered you the option of me recording remotely. I offered the option. You said, no, come over, just so you have someone here to hurl abuse at, apparently.
Pretty much. That's how it works.
It is. It's how all the good poisoning stories start. I'm not going to poison anyone this week, apart from, I don't know, the air for infecting me.
Right, so you're going to poison the air.
I've not thought it through.
I'd say I don't think you have thought that one through.
No, I mean, generally these sorts of plans...
I think this leads to bigger problems.
I'm not the kind of person who can plan out a long-plotted revenge against the elements. I would admire myself a lot if I did. I'd be the whole time. I'd be like, wow, you're really taking this plot against the air seriously.
Yeah, it's good to know. Good to know you have that commitment behind you.
Well, speaking of plotting against the elements and being entirely congealed, I think it's time for us to thank our delicious Patreon subscribers.
Oh, yes, indeed. And I hope they are not entirely congealed, because that sounds desperately unpleasant.
Well, the congealed and a nice jelly.
No, none of that. No congealing at all for anyone ever.
Okay, not in aspic.
No, not in anything. It is not a good verb. I congeal, you congeal, he, she congeals. It's like, no, that's not pleasant. Moving on. So anyway, thank you to the very non-congealed Canagabble. I may have pronounced that entirely wrongly.
And to Jessie Anne 81. Lovely, lovely, very sexy Patreon subscribers.
Indeed. Thank you very much for joining us. Hoping there's lots of exciting things going on over there.
You're hoping that there
I'm
are?
I'm hoping there's lots of exciting things.
There are.
Good. I'm glad they're still there.
Good news for you, Nick. There are.
I'm glad they're still there.
It's a wonderful place, Patreon. It's a lovely, lovely place. Do come and join us on the platform if you haven't already. Maybe you've dipped your toe in. Maybe you've had a little break. Now's a good time to rejoin. It's also available as a gift to your friends, families, and enemies. You can.
Absolutely.
You can buy an annual subscription. Fling that at someone.
Absolutely. Just in the street. Chuck it at them.
Yes.
Listen to this. It's aww, awesome.
Like giving out free hugs, but obviously paid for. And not a hug. And odd. Do that if we taught
you nothing.
I think
this is another example of Sinead's not really thinking things far ahead.
As I said, if I started a cult, it would be very fly by night. Well, Nick, are you ready? To drink cocktails and talk of poison.
Talk of poison.
Should mix it up.
So it would seem, well, I'm intrigued. You've mixed that one up on one of the alternatives.
Or we could drink of poison and speak verily of the cocktail.
That sounds so fun.
Well, which one do you want?
I don't know anymore.
Should we go with the first one?
If that was a good one, then okay, let's do that.
That involves more living. So let's go with the first one. Hooray, hooray, hooray. It is Nick's story this week. But of course, we can't possibly have a story without a cocktail in hand. As you know, dear listeners, every week we choose a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we will tell. And it will flavour our cocktail of the week. So with Nick's story, he gets to choose the secret ingredient. And the secret ingredient is, Nick?
It's a lovely little snake. It's a lovely little snake. It's a little slithery snake.
Every time there's an animal theme, you always go, it's a
lovely little poisonous snake.
I must say, choosing the picture for the secret ingredient post on social media today was a joy. Because there are many, many good snake pictures out there. I was particularly pleased with the one I chose.
Oh, I could have used the picture of you covered in snakes.
Oh, you could have. No, that one
massive
snake.
Well, it was a massive fucking massive anaconda type thing.
It wasn't an anaconda, Nick, in the streets of Canterbury.
20 foot long.
Eyes the size of saucers.
That they were.
No, as we've said before, there was a day where the tropical animal shop, tropical yes. pet. It was a tropical shop.
It was a tropical shop.
And there were animals in it. But they were out on the street having a bit of an open day. And I marched straight over there.
Did it give me that snake?
Yeah, and had a boa constrictor put around me. And the boa constrictor did not want to let go to the point where the guy got scared.
That's generally what they don't.
Yeah. It was great. Love a snake. I love a snake. Mm. Absolutely love them. I think they're gorgeous. I would own one if it was in any way nice to do so. They're huge.
Yeah. Less strokeable as well, I feel.
No, they love being stroked.
Really?
They're cold-blooded, so they want to nestle down and be warm with you. And you give them a little stroke, they love it.
No, none of that.
No.
Then they eat you.
Yeah, they definitely do that. Yeah, eventually, so they will eat you at night.
Yeah, that's less tempting, I have to say.
You're not a fan of a snake, are you?
No, I'm not frightened of snakes. I mean, if I saw one, I wouldn't like to go near it. But I don't run away from them. I won't run away. But I don't particularly want to have them in my house.
Okay.
If there was one here now, I would be alarmed. Well, I'm glad we've covered that.
Look, if you're going to put an animal as a secret ingredient, we're going to have a chat about it because, as you know, I will have feelings.
So many feelings.
There are some snake liquors. There are drinks involving snakes.
There are various drinks with snake wine.
Yes.
All those sorts of things.
What's snake wine?
Snake wine is a wine with snakes in it.
Is it just like a Merlot? It's just got a
It's not wine. It's just like a spirit, like a vodka pretty much, in a bottle which you put a snake in. And it sort of supposedly flavours the spirit in a snaky way.
Is the snake alive?
No, not at the time.
Right, okay.
No, very much a dead snake. I think relatively freshly dead snake, not like roadkill snake.
No, that would be weird. That would be weird, yeah. Apparently, yes, no.
My dad bought me, because he used to travel a lot for work and things, and he once bought me and my brother back a bottle with a cobra in it. It was literally still a snake wine. It was a cobra in a bottle of alcohol.
How big was the bottle?
No, just a normal, like, 70, like a litre sized thing.
Jesus.
And it had a fucking cobra in it.
Oh my, how did you get that through customs?
God knows. I think nothing to declare. No, nothing to declare at all.
Just me and my nine bottles of Cobra wine. What did you do with it? Did you drink it?
Oh God, no. I think we were relatively young at the time. I think we were probably around about...
What?
Well, sort of like 15, 16 sort of thing.
That's not what you want to have your first drink on.
So, yeah, so I don't think... I have no idea what actually happened to it. It definitely didn't get drunk. I think it ended up going in a skip or something after about 3 years of sitting on the shelf going, that's fucking weird.
That's the sort of thing at a house party that would be cracked open, wouldn't it? Mm. Let's have the Cobra wine.
Yeah,
it carries a terrible curse.
Absolutely.
Well, you didn't know what happened to it until tonight. No, we're not having the Cobra wine.
Having the Cobra wine, no.
Okay, well, with snake as the inspiration ingredient, what have you come up with?
So we're having something slightly different. We're not having that sort of snake-infused wine. We're going to have a rattlesnake.
A rattlesnake.
A rattlesnake.
Excellent.
Indeed.
Ooh, deadly. But maybe delicious.
Who can say?
Wonderful. Well, I think it is high time for us to slither into the poisonous cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm. So we'll see you in a minute.
We'll see you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello.
Oh, Nick, a rattlesnake.
A rattlesnake.
Now, this looks very pretty.
Mmm.
And it's... The way you've done it, I don't know if it's... I'm assuming it's intentionally done like that, but we have a really, really lovely kind of amber yellow drink, a foamy head, and it's like in the head you've put the snake bite marks in it.
Well, see, I did that, and then I hadn't twigged that, and I did something just random squiggly patterns on mine. I had not twigged like the bitiness. I had not.
Yeah.
I had not considered, but I'm going to say, yes, I did that. It was entirely on purpose.
You'll see it in the cocktail pictures that we share this evening. But yeah, the way Nick has done my one, it does look like the teeth marks, the fang marks.
Fair enough, let's go with that.
Of a snake? You've done very well, Nick.
Well done,
you're
me.
You're genius, you absolutely
I'm
genius.
So
you.
Very good.
Ooh, what's it going to taste like? Is it going to take snaky and rattly and...
Rattly.
A poison? A venom?
Venom, it's, it tastes venomous.
That's yeah, rattlesnakes are pretty deadly, aren't they? Pretty deadly.
Okay.
It's not as deadly as an anaconda, which just eats you. These are my very, very tenuous snake
excellent,
facts here.
Excellent snake facts.
Excellent.
With like John Voight coming up a river.
God, that's a good film.
It's an excellent film.
God, that's a good film. He's so bad in it. So it's very pretty. Smells of aromatic.
Smells of booze.
Smells of booze. Excellent. Well, Merry Christmas.
Merry
Let's
Christmas.
Dive in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That was not what I was expecting.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know what you were expecting.
Not that.
Well, it doesn't taste bad.
No, no,
it's,
it doesn't.
It's very nice, actually, yeah.
I thought it was going to be a lot stronger. I thought it was going to be a lot more malt heavier, a lot boozier than it is.
Yeah, it's very citrusy. Nice mouthfeel. Mm. I'm going to venture that there's some egg white in here, hence the foamy head. Very nice.
Yeah, no, that's good. I for something called a rattlesnake, I was expecting something sharp and bitey.
I was expecting something with a lot more punch,
yeah,
I think.
Yes, indeed, as was I.
Which, this is very smooth and lovely. Mm. This is more of a, I don't know, some sort of silkworm.
Some sort of cuddly toy we have
here. Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
It's quite pleasant. I'll go with that.
You going to talk us through it?
Well, I mean, it's basically whiskey.
What?
A lot of whiskey. It's rye
really?
Whiskey. Yeah, in there. Bloody with hell. Some lemon juice. The recipe calls for a muscovado sugar syrup. Now, I didn't have any muscovado sugar syrup, so I've used agave, which I thought might have the same sort of notes to it. And then with a bit of an absinthe rinse in the glass.
Ah, okay.
So I thought a combination of rye and absinthe, I thought it's going to blow your head off. But perhaps there's too much agave. I don't know if it's a lot sweeter than a muscovado, because it certainly has tempered the whole thing right down. Mm. It's perfectly pleasant. It's perfectly pleasant, but it's not the punch that I was anticipating.
Yes, agave is quite sweet, but I don't find it much sweeter than other sugar syrups. And I've used muscovado sugar syrup. I've made it at home. It's pretty sweet. It's just a little bit more flavours of molasses, which would, I suppose, match with the whiskey. It's a sweet cocktail. I'm not going, oh my God, it's over the top. But maybe it's the egg white in there.
Oh, there is an egg white in there as well. As Sinead did say. There is an egg white, yes, which you get the lovely foaminess is due to a neat egg white.
If you just had that neat without the egg white.
I don't know if that would change the flavour profile so much. I think it is the combination of the lemon and the sugar are really mellowing the whole thing down, whole thing out.
Yeah, that's really intriguing.
I would be intrigued to try it with a lot less sugar.
Because it's a lovely drink. It really is really nice. And we're nitpicking. It's 108 episodes, so we're going to nitpick here. I guess, yeah, we were expecting something sharp and punchy for a rattlesnake. Maybe it's just down to the naming of it.
Yeah, potentially.
It's a really clever cocktail because, again, nice. I would not have said that there was whiskey in there. Mm. The absinthe as well.
It's a rye whiskey.
Well, a rye. It's still bloody whiskey.
It's still whiskey.
It's still whiskey. It's still a whiskey. Gin, is it?
It's not gin.
But with the absinthe rinse as well. That's foxed me. That's foxed me. Couldn't have told you what was in that apart from lemon and egg white and the venom of a snake that is not very powerful.
Not very powerful at all.
Oh my God, is that what being bitten like by a rattlesnake is like?
Unlikely.
You go into a fuzzy, snuggly, kind of lovely, warm place.
And then your face melts.
Okay, that's not what a rattlesnake bite does either. You've been watching Raiders of the Lost Ark too much and getting very confused.
Very confused about what's going on there.
Fallen asleep watching one film, woken up with another one and went, oh, that's how snake bites work.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Well, I am very happy to drink it.
No, absolutely. We'll go with that.
But we're still going to pick at it all night, aren't we? We have become very picky and judgmental. If we'd been served
what do you mean
this,
we've become picky and judgmental?
More so. I didn't think it was possible, Nick. If we had this on week, I don't know, 5 of this show, we'd have gone, what a triumph, what a lovely thing. We're like, no, the name and the combination of things is not quite right.
Do it again.
Well, you'll have to mix up more later, and then we'll experiment. But with our rattlesnakes, cautiously in hand.
Cautiously.
Because we don't quite trust them, and I don't quite trust this cocktail, but I'm going to drink it. Is it time for a story?
It most certainly is.
Yay!
Most certainly is. So I'm going to get right in there, and we're going to reveal the naming of our cocktail, our secret ingredient, pretty much straight away. And some of you may well have guessed who we're going to talk about today.
Okay.
So we are going to have the story of Charles Sobrage.
Ooh.
A killer who became known as the Serpent.
Right. Oh, okay.
So there we go. We're right in there.
Okay.
Now, I'd say that is quite a cool serial killer sobriquet. The Serpent.
The Serpent.
It's a good name. He was also known as the Bikini Killer.
Okay.
Which is so much less cool.
I did not know that he was called the Bikini Killer.
Also the Bikini. The Serpent was a much later development.
Yes.
At the time, it was the Bikini Killer.
Which is a B-movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Serpent and the Bikini Killer is a brilliant B-movie that I want to watch.
Yeah.
Bikini Killer, that is... I think there must be a film that's called that, actually. The Bikini Killer. What did he do? I don't know. He killed bikinis. Or he killed wearing a bikini.
He hated bikinis. He killed them all.
I've heard of your man.
Good.
Because I can't pronounce his surname.
Subraj.
Subraj. I've heard of the serpent. I know there's been a TV show about him recently. Did not watch it, so I really don't know the story.
Well, you're quite right. So I have been planning on doing this story for quite some time. It's been from the very first us talking about doing this podcast. Mm. He has been on my list. I think it was January 2021.
Yes.
The BBC brought out the series, a TV series called The Serpent, based on a dramatisation of this chap's life. Yeah. Then I thought, ooh, you bastards, I can't do that now. Because he's all over the place and everyone's going to know. So I put it on the back burner. But I thought, yeah, it's 2022 now.
Yeah.
Everyone's forgotten what that TV series was about. So let's do it. We shall begin at the beginning.
It's a very good place to start.
Charles was born Hotchand Bawani Gamukka Subraj.
Okay.
This is a real name.
From where?
Born in April 1944. He's the illegitimate son of a Vietnamese peasant girl and a very wealthy Indian merchant who was living in Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam. Now, despite promises of wedding bells, soon after his birth, Charles's father abandons his young son and marries an Indian woman, leaving Charles and his mother to fend for themselves.
Oh.
Now, not long after this, Charles's mother begins a relationship with a French lieutenant who is stationed in Vietnam. And when Charles was 4 years old, they marry. And they go on to have several children of their own between them, who unfortunately certainly receive more attention, more love, especially from their father. Charles is somewhat left out in the cold. Now, after the Second World War, the French, with the help of the Brits, obviously, are trying to re-establish control of all their sort of former colonies that have been liberated or invaded during the war, and sort of Vietnam was invaded by Japan and such.
Yes, come crawling back, have
you? So the French and the Brits try and re-establish their control of these colonies. The Vietnamese go, no, don't think so, thank you, we're fine. And there was quite a vicious battle between the sort of communist Vietnamese and the French and British forces trying to re-establish colonial control. It's not a fun place to be. And eventually, in 1953, Charles's stepfather takes the whole family back to France.
Aye.
It's just a miserable place to live. And they witness some horrendous things. But even back in Europe, Charles hates his life in France, especially the Catholic boarding school in Paris, where he's sent to be pretty much out of sight, out of mind. He is the only one of sort of an Asian descent in this boarding school full of sort of French lads. So everyone calls him names and they're very mean to him and no one talks to him. It is not a fun place to be at all. But apparently he is able to pull off an excellent Charlie Chaplin impersonation, which is why he gets the name Charles.
What?
So while in school, and probably he's doing his best to fit in or something. So he starts impersonating the people he sees on in the films or something of the day.
Yeah.
So he's able, apparently he's quite good at this Charlie Chaplin bit that he does. Probably a lot of the sort of the French kids as well, not being able to pronounce his actual name particularly well, struggling with that, go, well, Charles is easier for her to say. So, and Charles sticks.
Okay.
He hates life in France so much that he runs away twice. He goes all the way back to Vietnam to try and connect with his father. Now this is a time before major air travel is available, so we're talking sort of like late 50s, something like that. So it would have been a boat to get back to Vietnam at this point. How he afforded it, or if he was like, if he stowed away on a cargo vessel or something, but he managed to do this. And both times he is sent packing by his father, so you're not wanted here, back to France.
To do that twice.
But he does it. So obviously desperately trying to connect with his father. He's having a miserable time in France. The French lieutenant, not interested in it whatsoever. So he's trying to go and find his real father.
Well, he wants to go back to his home
and
country.
Desperate to get back to his roots. Eventually, after, say, a couple of these back and forth, Charles's father agrees that Charles can visit for a trial period to see how he gets on. And yes, I will pay for a ticket. He's a wealthy man. I'll pay for a ticket for Charles to come over, not having to stow away on a cargo ship or something. Money for the tickets never arrives. And Charles is distraught and furious about this, what he sees as this sort of betrayal, really.
Yeah.
And he turns to robbery, car theft, any sort of petty crime in France, primarily to try and get enough money to get a ticket together to go over, and he ends up in jail. But far from deterring him from a life of crime, as jail is meant to do, he actually thrives inside, making connections with various criminal gangs who operate throughout the city.
How old around this time?
So probably around this time, he is going to be mid-teens.
Wow.
Sort of, yeah, late teens, I think.
It's a very sad start, isn't it?
Yeah.
This desperation to go home, I guess, and also for daddy to recognise him. Yep. And, you know, clearly a man of power and a man of wealth. Maybe he's not the favourite child at home. Yeah. And the second with his stepfather either.
Yeah, absolutely. So his father's got a new life with his new wife and I think new children. His mother's got a new life with a stepfather and new children there. And he's sort of left going, will someone love me?
Well, it's not a very nice time or place to be an immigrant, really, is it?
Not at all. And France is just coming out of being after the Second World War. So France is as poor as anything as well, trying to rebuild after that disaster. When he is finally released, he still continues with his goal of trying to reconnect with his father, and he finally gets back to Vietnam. The family reunion is somewhat tense. Charles's father agrees, fine, you can stay for a bit, see how things go. However, when Charles writes off his father's new car, this does not go down well.
He
takes the car without permission and manages to write it off. He is then packed off, but this time to India to live with relatives. His father's an Indian merchant, a businessman. Yeah. He is packed off to live with relatives in India. This also does not particularly go well, and he manages again to find his way across to Vietnam, back to his father. His father is not interested at all. No interest in getting to know his son, and again sends him back to France.
So what's this dynamic that he's trying to go back and forth? I mean, maybe we'll talk about it later, but it seems quite a cycle of destruction.
Absolutely. Yeah, you'd have thought, because this is about the third, fourth time or so he's tried to reconnect with his father. Why expecting this time to go any different than the others when they have been steadily getting worse? And of course it doesn't go any different. His father is just not interested and just cannot get through to Charles. I don't want to see you. Charles is returned to France. And again, when he's back there, it's petty theft, stealing cars, and he is locked up twice. But after the second stint inside, he emerges determined to go straight. He said, no, I'm going to do it. I'm over all this nonsense with my father. I'm going to sort my life out, get on with it. He finds a job. He begins a relationship with a woman named Chantel. Life on the straight and narrow is proving really, really difficult and not at all easy. This getting a job malarkey, this earning your money, it's difficult. It's hard. It's rather boring. But whereas before he could just go and steal what he wanted, now it's like, oh, it's really difficult to get going. Eventually, he falls back into old tricks. He is jailed again, this time for forging checks in his sister's name. Charles is freed when she agrees to drop the charges. Mm. He continues bouncing checks under various acquaintances' names and eventually saves up about 30,000 francs. On the night that he proposed to Chantel, he is arrested yet again for evading police in a stolen car and sent back to prison.
That is not a good proposal.
It's not a good proposal, absolutely.
Darling, please, will you marry me? Quickly. Going to need your answer quite soon.
But Chantel waits for him, and the pair are married upon his release. Although Charles is now always having some scheme underway, and he's under constant suspicion from the police, who are keeping track of his every move. Charles and Chantel decide they need to get out of France. They need to get away, fresh start, somewhere else. The couple travel from France through Eastern Europe using fake documents and robbing people who befriended them as they go, and eventually arriving in Bombay, now Mumbai, around 1970. This is a long old trek across country.
Yeah, that's quite a way.
They have to go from France on foot or hitchhiking, getting buses, that sort of stuff, all the way to India.
They're young, they're travelling, they're robbing people. Absolutely. Haven't we all in our youth?
I say, eventually they get to India around 1970, and Chantel gives birth to a baby girl. Once they sort of slightly get settled in India, Charles resumes his criminal lifestyle, car theft, a bit of smuggling every now and again.
Oh, okay.
He's made some connections on his travels through.
What's he smuggling? So,
well, I don't know what details, to be honest. I don't think it's drugs at this point or anything, although we move into that territory later. At this point, I think it's contraband that they can't get in particular countries. So he's
rattlesnakes,
a lot of rattlesnakes in the pockets, getting through customs.
Other kind of snakes. People need snakes.
But the profits he gets from these various endeavours are mainly used to fund a growing gambling addiction. Yay. In 1973, he is involved in a botched armed robbery at a hotel jewellery store, which leads to his arrest and, again, his imprisonment. But this time, with his wife's help, he is able to fake an illness. He fakes...
Right.
He claims to be having incredible stomach pains, stomach cramps and things like that. And doctors actually believe that he has got appendicitis.
Yeah.
An ambulance is called and he's sent to the local hospital, has a perfectly good appendix removed.
Okay.
And while he's in hospital, he is able to escape. He makes his escape.
Wait, he goes through with the operation?
Goes through with the operation, apparently.
Couldn't he have... What?
I'm sure at the time the plan was I shall escape before they operate. But either he's under such tight guard, they think, well, afterwards we can let the guard down a bit because he's drugged up and stuff like that. He's in no state to run anywhere.
He was acting too well. The doctor was like, no, we must operate immediately. No, give me 20 minutes. Just let me lie down in this darkened room in here. No, out it comes. Yeah. So he's crawling out of the hospital.
Yeah, let me lie near this open window. I'll be fine. I need a fresh air.
Fresh air, that's what I need. Fresh air and a walk on the beach.
Yeah, I mean, they are captured pretty quickly. So he's not able...
I'm surprised, he's probably bleeding out.
Yeah, exactly. They follow the blood trail around the corner and there he is. So he's not able to get far. And this time he actually resorts to begging his father for money to bail him out. His father is not happy but does agree and sends this money to sort him out. And once he is out, they flee India, this time for Afghanistan. Now in Kabul, the couple resume their habit of robbing tourists. Now these tourists are following the hippie trail, the overland route from between Europe and India. Mm. So it runs through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nepal, India. So it was a long, and a lot of people made this travel sort of in the 60s, 70s, to reconnect with their sort of the Eastern mysticism of the time like. These were prime targets for Charles's schemes. He is caught yet again robbing tourists or conning them out of their money, but he yet again escapes with the help of his wife, again faking an illness. What illness he decides to do on this time, I'm not sure, but he's able to use this ploy once more to escape, potentially.
It's really itchy. I need yogurt.
This time, though, Chantal has actually had enough.
They have
a young daughter in tow as well, and they cannot be constantly on the run, thieving their way around the world. It's not the way to bring up a young family. Chantal ends up returning to France with their child and vows never to see Charles again. Mm. Now, freshly escaped and with only himself to look after, Charles leaves Afghanistan and flees to Iran. Charles spends the next 2 years pretty much on the run, stealing passports as he needed, travelling throughout Eastern Europe and the Middle East, always making local connections with the various criminal gangs of the cities and countries he passes through, delving deeper and deeper into a very murky world of drug trafficking as he goes. He ends up in Istanbul and is joined by one of his younger brothers, Andre, who quickly becomes a pawn in many of Charles's schemes. Now, Andre is out there trying to reconnect with his older brother, much looks up to his older brother.
Oh, you imagine him just turning up, bright-eyed, backpack and baseball cap on his thing. Yeah. Hey, big brother, I'm here to reconnect. Show me the sights. I will definitely show you the sights.
Exactly.
Hold all of this stuff for me, and if anyone asks, it's just a packet of cake. Absolutely fine. I'm taking this for my brother. He trusts me so well. Oh, dear God.
Yeah, so this is one of his step brothers from France. So Charles does not look fondly on these relations. But Andre is out there trying to reconnect with his brother. No, don't do that. Andre, you're a fool. The brothers are indeed eventually arrested in Athens after one of their schemes goes awry. Mm-hmm. Charles escape, yet again using his patented feigning illness ploy. Mm-hmm. But his brother is apparently not in on that particular plan.
Oh.
And Charles abandons Andre to serve an 18-year prison sentence in Greece.
Oh my God.
So now on the run yet again, Charles financed his lifestyle by either posing as a gem dealer sometimes or as a drug dealer, depending on the company he was in.
He
pretty much was a drug dealer. I'm not sure whether gem dealer, probably for the slightly higher sort of people who aren't interested in your drugs, people who are looking for something a bit more fancy. I'm a rare stones dealer.
As you walk down the street, you know, you're always looking for different people on the different corner. Drugs? No, I want something different. You want some gems?
You want some gems?
You want some gems? Over there, there's someone just selling money. No, that's an ATM. We're confused.
But it seems to work on the different types of people he's after. And he befriends many of these travellers and strikes when they let their guard down, either robbing them blind, conning them out of cash. In Thailand, he meets Marie-Andrée Leclerc from Quebec. Now, she is one of these many tourists looking for adventure in the Middle East, and is quickly enamoured with Charles and his life of adventure, his ability to get drugs very easily.
Always a plus.
I'm sure this helps, but she becomes entirely devoted to Charles. Mm. Frequently turns a blind eye to his crimes and his various affairs with any woman who comes along, really. But she is more and more besotted with Charles. Charles starts to build up a bit of a loyal group of followers around him. He would help people out of difficult situations so that they became almost indebted to him, really, and more than willing to repay the various kindnesses, the various favours that he had used to help them out. What they didn't know is that Charles was the one who had organised their misfortune in the first place. In one case, he helped two former French policemen named Yannick and Jacques to recover their passports that, in fact, he himself had stolen. Charles had stolen them. And then he, yes, I'll help you with all my connections and everything. We'll go to the police. We'll find your passports. And then here are your passports.
Brilliant.
And they are delighted and will do anything to help him.
Indebted to you.
Absolutely.
And they're reliant on you.
Precisely. In another scheme, he provides shelter and comfort to another Frenchman, Dominique Renaud, who's near death from dysentery, but was actually the result of poison Charles had given him. And Charles nursed him back to health.
Of course,
Dominique is entirely beholden to Charles and so grateful that he came across this guardian angel on his travels who was able to help him. Around the same sort of time, he's also joined by a young Indian chap, A.J. Chowdhury. Now, he himself has got a bit of a sketchy reputation. He's a bit of a con man, a bit of a petty thief, and he becomes sort of Charles's lieutenant, really, sort of second in command. Charles seems determined to build almost a criminal family, a bit of a around him. I think he was aiming for sort of almost like a Manson-style following around him. He very much believed that he was a cult leader in the making. He was going to be one of the big names.
Yeah.
In 1975, Charles and A.J. Chowdhury commit their first known murder. Several of their victims, it seems, had spent some time with Charles's developing cult before their deaths, and it is more than likely that they had been potential recruits, people who had come to Charles for some sort of aid or something, but they end up turning against Charles. They seem to see through his facade that he puts up, this benevolent man, and they threaten to go to the authorities and expose his schemes. And obviously, he cannot allow this.
No, that's
never a good thing.
If you come across some sort of benevolent leader who has lots of followers, and then you find out they're not doing nice things, don't confront them with it and say, I'm going to go to the police, because it's not going to end well.
No. Their first victim seems to be a young woman from Seattle, Teresa Knowlton. She originally had been, again, enamoured with Charles, but had become slightly disenfranchised, mainly by him shagging everyone else he could find, which is definitely not good, and the sort of witnessing some of the slightly more weird drug-related activities he's up to. So she wants out, really. One day, Charles very kindly offers, okay, fine, I will take you to the nearest city of Pattaya in Thailand. I will take you there, and then you can go on your own way. Her strangled and burned body was found by police on the outskirts of the city.
Oh.
Now, soon after, Jenny Bolivar, another American tourist, was found drowned in a tidal pool in the Gulf of Thailand wearing a flowered bikini. Now, at first, the death was assumed to be some horrific accident just gone wrong. She had just had too much drink, fallen off a cliff or whatever, and had drowned. But later, the autopsy and forensic evidence revealed she had indeed been poisoned, been left in the pool to disguise it. It was the flowery bikini that Jenny and several of his other victims later were found in that earned Charles the nickname the Bikini Killer.
Just putting bikinis on the victims to make it look like they've been out swimming.
Exactly, they've been out swimming.
They're tourists, they don't know what they're doing, foolish people.
Precisely.
That's exactly
That's exactly what is thought. But when they would talk to friends and things, well, no, she didn't own anything like that. They are dressed up like this to disguise the crime. For Charles, murder seems to get easier and easier and easier. His next victim is Vitaly Hakim, a Turkish drug dealer who foolishly decides to try and compete with Charles, try and muscle in some of Charles's territory. He is beaten, his neck is broken, he's doused in gasoline and set alight.
That'll do it.
I mean, absolutely. That's going to sort it out. Next, two Dutch students, Henk Bitanja, who's 29, and his fiancée Cornelia Hemke, 25. They are invited to Thailand after meeting Charles in Hong Kong. So he travels around an awful lot. Not long after they arrive, the couple fall horribly ill. Horribly ill. Charles insists they stay with him. They know no one else in Thailand at all. So they are incredibly grateful to Charles that he would be willing to give up his time and look after them. He slowly nurtures them back to health, making them more and more dependent on his support. Now, while they are convalescing, Charles gets an unexpected visitor, Charmaine Carew. Now, she is the girlfriend of the Turkish drug dealer, Vitali Hakim, who had been killed and set alight some time back. She is she is on the hunt for her boyfriend. The last piece of information that he was going to be meeting with Charles, he had connected with Charles. So has Charles seen him at all? What's going on? Charles starts to get slightly nervous at this. He didn't realise that people had been able to track him down. Mm. He thought he was pretty much off the grid. No one knew where he was. But obviously this woman has been able to find me. Anyone else could find me. And he doesn't like that. It is time to move on.
There's no social media at the time. There's no internet. Everyone's just probably not going to be traceable. But that's stupid as well. If you kill someone, someone's going to come and look for you.
Yeah. The bodies of Henk Britanja and Cornelia Hemke were discovered strangled and burnt on the 16th of December, 1975. A few days later, Charmaine Carew's body is found floating in a pool wearing a flowery bikini. Now, Charles Marie Leclerc, the Canadian woman who is still very much with her, travelled to Nepal using the passports they have stolen from Henk and Cornelia. Mm. So they have stolen their identities and they're now in Nepal. There, he robbed, drugged and strangled and burnt tourists Laurent Carrière and Connie Brosnick.
Okay, just off the plane.
Absolutely. Just some stuff
in
around there.
In customs. Yep.
Well, they know that Henk and Cornelia are going to be discovered in Thailand, their body, the Dutch tourists, and they have got their passports. They need new identities. They can't continue using these passports because these are now dead people. They need new IDs. The other way to get new IDs is to steal them off someone, and those people need to be shut up.
It seems so obvious, but we're in the digital age now. You have a digital fingerprint, you have a digital trace. Back then it was just like, no, we'll just steal someone's passport, and if anyone asks questions, we'll kill them, and we can just be that person.
Absolutely, because now, that happens now, instantly across the world, that person is registered as passports are cancelled, and it happens instantly across the globe.
You're tracked and everything.
Back then, when everything is just literally a bit of paper that you've got,
you look a little bit like them.
You look a little bit like them or something, that you can get away with it. Yeah. And it takes a long time for information to travel around the place. Mm. Charles Marie slip out of Nepal after he is interviewed as a possible witness about the murders of Cornelia and Laurent. Thankfully, the police do not keep him. He's able to spin a good enough yarn. Yeah. Yes, he met them in a bar. He met them somewhere. Doesn't know anything that happened. The police go, okay, if you think of anything, then come and let us know. Mm. They head to the port. They are out of there using the passport of the two dead tourists.
Did the police not need to search them?
Well, I don't think they have a warrant. I don't think they have the passports with them. They're probably stashed away somewhere or something like that. They're not being brought into the police station.
They're holding them and fanning themselves with them.
Indeed. The pair return to Thailand. All is not well in Thailand, but when he gets back, he discovers that three of his followers there have started to suspect him, started to think things are not right here. Mm. They had found documents belonging to several of the murder victims amongst Charles's things. They'd initially refused to believe that Charles would have anything to do with the deaths of these old followers, these old friends. But how would he have got all these papers otherwise? Yeah. How would he be in possession of all these documents? The three men go to the authorities in Thailand with their suspicions and then return to France to escape retribution from Charles. Learning of this betrayal and that the Thai police are very interested in having a conversation with him, he manages to keep his head down until he is able to arrange passage to Calcutta. There he murders Israeli scholar Avoni Jacob for his passport, using it to move to Singapore. Then rather boldly he returns to Bangkok after this. Now this is March 1976, so he's been jumping all over the bloody place, but he's now in Bangkok and the police are still very keen to speak to Charles in connection to these sort of unsolved murders.
So why has he gone back?
Well, this is the question. We don't really know why he thinks he can get away with it. He's in a different part of the country. So he thinks, well, they're not going to still be looking for me, surely.
Why did he keep going back to daddy the first few times?
This is very true. So absolutely. He's gone back. But the police are very much still interested to speak to him. And they are able to track him down and bring him in for questioning. But then they let him off the hook and he goes free. It is later.
The police are rubbish, okay? The police are they're as bad as Victorian doctors at this stage. They're like, we need to talk to you.
Just wait.
Oh, for God's sake.
It is later revealed that the police had received instruction from higher up the chain to keep the news of these murders very low key. They were all individual murders. They weren't connected. Don't you dare say serial killer. They fear the negative publicity is going to affect the tourism. for Thailand.
Right.
It's a few isolated incidents of tourists getting into fights, getting into trouble and ending up dead. We do not say serial killer. Because it is going to terrify people and Thailand's economy relies on tourism.
And I do understand that to a point.
To a point.
To a tiny, tiny point of, no, we must not affect the tourism trade. It is one of their biggest sources of income. How is that any more reassuring? Just people die in Thailand. Don't worry. You come in, any fucker might have you. It's all right. You could die. You could be found, murdered anywhere. If it's one guy, you can probably keep your eye out a little bit. I know it's a serial killer if they're operating in that area. That's better than just saying people are just being killed in our country. They're short-sighted and I don't like it. And also the fucking serial killer, they just let go.
Yeah.
Yes, can't have that. I'm tainted on the country.
Now, fortunately, there is someone who agrees with you. A Dutch diplomat.
Good. I love the Dutch.
Herman Knippenberg.
Great name.
Is investigating the murder of the two Dutch backpackers. And Herman suspects Charles. He thinks he is responsible for their deaths. He's completely unaware of the other connected cases at this point. He's focusing on the two Dutch people. But he starts to build a bit of a case against him, doing some sort of armchair sleuthing, really. The police actually give him permission to conduct a search of Charles's apartment. Charles has been out of the country. Don't know when he's coming back. So yes, the police say, yes, okay, go and have a look. He finds passports and documents in a variety of names, along with medicines that turn out to be laced with poison.
Yeah.
But Charles has fled the country. No one knows where he is. Charles, Marie and Chowdhury were in fact living it up in Malaysia.
Oh, no.
This
Malaysia's
time.
Lovely.
Malaysia is a lovely place, perhaps on one of the lovely islands. They're having a jolly old time. There, Charles and Chowdhury, they steal a shipment of precious stones, some that are destined to a wealthy client in Singapore. After the theft, Chowdhury was never seen again. Yeah. And his body hasn't, to this day, never been found. It is believed that Charles murders his former accomplice before, this time heading to Geneva, Switzerland, in order to sell on their now stolen gems.
God, poor Switzerland. Switzerland gets such a bad rap, yeah. Sort of thing. Neutrality.
Exactly.
Bring it on.
Bring in your dodgy gems.
Yes. Thailand right now is just going, okay, people have died, but the beaches are amazing.
The beaches are lovely. Now, with pockets full of cash from their gems, the couple are soon back in Asia with a plan to rebuild his clan. They start in Bombay this time. Barbara Cheryl Smith and Mary Ellen Ether, who had travelled to the east to find enlightenment. They find Charles. He once again tries his old poison trick. Again on a Frenchman, Jean-Luc Solomon. The poison is only supposed to incapacitate him, so Charles can rob him and then come to his rescue.
Yes.
Of course, unknown to Charles, Jean-Luc has an underlying medical condition and quickly succumbs to the poison. Ooh. The two new recruits are slightly terrified by this development. This is all meant to be a jolly ruse. He's gonna feel ill for a bit. He'll nurse him back to health and everyone will be very jolly and happy. No one expects death at this point. Murder is a whole nother level. Charles convinced them it is all a dreadful, dreadful accident. I mean, it was a dreadful accident, but it's never going to happen again. And they go, okay, fine.
Because I suppose everyone else he's murdered, he's taken those people off, disposed of them, there we go, in the folds of his little tiny following. They're not expecting to have a dead body
Absolutely.
On their hands
no,
to
no,
deal with.
No, indeed not. Indeed
Naive
not.
As they are.
In 1976, in New Delhi, Charles and the three women he is with, they trick a tour group of French students into accepting them as guides. Now, on some reports I read, this tour group is about 60 strong.
What?
There are a lot of, they're all French students, and now being guided around by Charles. He then drugs them with pills that he pretends are anti-dysentery medicine.
Right.
So take one of them. We're going to the countryside. You best take one of these. You don't want to get a dodgy tummy in there. So take one of these pills. You'll be right as rain. However, the drugs start to act too quickly. And pretty much the students start dropping unconscious where they stand. Ooh. Like within minutes of taking this drug, they're on the floor. A number of them quickly realise that they have been drugged and they are able to overpower Charles. The bigger ones, then the drug is not taking effect quite as quickly and they are able to overpower Charles and alert the authorities to what has happened to their friends. Charles, Marie, Barbara and Mary are all arrested. During interrogation, Barbara and Mary quickly crack and confess to everything. Absolutely everything. Charles is charged with the murder of Solomon, and all four are sent to Tihar Prison outside New Delhi, which is a hellhole.
Yeah.
Absolute hellhole. And they left there while they are waiting trial. So now, conditions inside this notorious prison are unbearable. Both Barbara and Mary attempt suicide during they wait 2 years for their trial to happen, and things are so bad that they try to kill themselves. Charles, however, has entered prison with a variety of precious stones discreted about himself.
Okay, nice.
And with the right bribe to the right officer, the right warden, the right guard, he's having a great time.
Yeah.
He is living quite comfortably. Eventually, when they get to trial, Charles turns this into a bit of a show. He hires and fires lawyers all over the place. He even brings in his recently paroled, and for God knows why reason, his still old brother, Andre, who's just been released out of prison in Athens, to sort of give a character witness.
Oh, God.
For Charles. And going, what the hell are you? But Andre's there going, yes, he's my brother, he's very nice.
Poor Andre is an idiot. He's so wide-eyed. Yeah. He's probably like, I made a foolish mistake. The lawyer's, really? Really? The catalogue of death that he has left in his wake.
Yeah.
Nothing's ringing a bell with you here. I'm sure it was all just a misunderstanding. Andre is an idiot, and he deserves to go back to jail. Put him in jail for all of this business. Again, stupid.
Somehow Charles manages to escape the death penalty, which is very much
but that
in vogue.
That is
in
very...
And he is sentenced to 12 years in prison, which I thought was a surprisingly light sentence for that. But he's sentenced
to
12 years.
They sort of tend to go deaf or nothing.
Well, yeah, potentially true. Marie Leclerc, she is also found guilty, but this time of drugging the French student. She is later paroled and returned to Canada. She was still claiming her innocence, and she dies at home in April 1984. Now, Charles's systematic bribery of the prison guards at Tihar, it reached slightly outrageous levels. He lives a life of pretty much luxury inside this maximum security, miserable prison. He has a TV in his cell. He has food prepared from him individually. He doesn't eat what the rest of the prisoners have. He has nice food. He befriends the guards and the prisoners. He would sort of like walk in and out of jail whenever he fancied. He would take a trip into the local village. As long as you're back by bedtime, then it's fine. It's not a bother at all. He revels in his notoriety, and he invites authors and journalists to come to interview him in prison. Any request for someone to come and see him and see how marvellous, what a lovely time he's having.
Look at me.
He loves it. Now, despite his comfortable surroundings in the prison, there is one thing that is causing him major concern. He is going.
Is it the diamond that was stuck?
It's not the diamond that is stuck. It's that he's going to be released too soon. He knows that the Thai authorities are still after him for the murders he has committed in Thailand. Now, his relatively short sentence of 12 years would mean that when he is released, the statute of limitations on murder in Thailand, which was 20 years at the time, would not have elapsed.
No.
So he would have been extradited straight to Thailand, and he would be dead.
Yes.
There is no doubt that is going to be execution for you. He needs a way to extend his stay in India. If he can just creep over that 20-year mark from his crimes in Thailand, he can walk out scot-free.
So what's he going to do?
In March 1986, on the 10th anniversary of his time in prison, he throws a party. A lovely, great big party in the prison. For his prisoner friends and his guard friends. Everyone's welcome.
No one's questioning that.
He falls back onto one of his old tricks. He drugs all the food and drink at the party with sleeping pills.
Right.
That he's been able to smuggle in, no doubt with a healthy bribe of some shiny, shiny things.
My head is in my hands. Okay. Right. Don't go to a party in prison, people. What did you think was going to happen at this banquet that he's laid on?
Well, he's been so good for 10 years. He's been a model prisoner for 10 years.
Yes.
So why would you suspect now?
Because of the bloody law. That's why.
I don't think the extradition things had occurred to the wardens and the guards there. Something that in Charles's mind, very much so, but I don't think they had considered that.
They're like, I think it must have applied to some people, but then, you know, the people who turned up, like, oh, free food.
Well, pretty much, free food.
I mean,
absolutely.
I would turn up to a free buffet to be. If there was one in prison, I'd go as a visitor and then just, mop it up. Yeah, great. Oh, there's a shrimp.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. And they go for it. They eat everything in sight. And when most of the guards and prisoners are fast asleep, dreaming lovely, lovely dreams, he walks out the front door.
For God's sake!
He just walks out the front door.
Jesus Christ.
But his plan is not to flee. He is not trying to escape the country or anything like that. He purely wants to escape prison. He is caught within 3 days and sent back to prison. And his prison term is extended for 10 years.
So it'd be 22 years.
So it'd be 22 yeah. 20 years in jail. When he, and he is still living his life of comfort and loveliness.
So maybe it's a ploy with the guards. Maybe they've all gone, you know what, I'll knock you out. I'm going to walk out. I have to make it look like this. You guys are all on board with this. Okay, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
You had no control over me.
Potentially. Potentially, oh, so
God.
There may have been some...
So he goes back in 10 years?
So he goes back in. He goes back in. He's in there for 10 years. Comfortable, lovely surroundings, lovely food being prepared for him. All very comfortable, knowing that when he is released, Thailand cannot touch him. He is released on the 17th of February. And there is nothing the Thai authorities can do. Too much time has passed. Evidence also has been lost, and few people remember anything about his crimes by this point. It's a long distant memory. No country particularly wants him. Indian authorities allow him to return to France a free man. In France, Charles cashes in on his pretty outrageous lifestyle. He charges extortionate fees for interviews, films, book rights to his story. One French producer paid $15 million for the rights to be able to tell his story. As more and more details of his life are revealed and published in exposés and books, his ability to constantly sort of slither out of trouble earns him the nickname The Serpent. Now, had Charles been happy with his retirement and his newfound fortune, he would no doubt still be a free man to this day. But the draw to Asia seemed to be too much. And he returned to Nepal and hits the casinos. There he is recognised by a journalist at the Casino Royale in Kathmandu. Charles does his best to pass himself off as a regular tourist, but the journalist is persistent and was soon able to confirm it was indeed Charles Sobhraj he was trailing. The journalist notified the police. And 2 days later, Charles is arrested for the 1975 murders of Connie Brosnick and Laurent Carré. And he is sentenced to life in prison. And there, Charles Sobhraj remains to this day.
Oh, is he still alive?
Still there.
Oh, my God.
It's a crazy story. The crazy story of the serpent.
The serpent. What a story, Nick. Woo-hoo! Thank you for that one.
There's an awful lot going on there.
It's a really interesting element of that, is this draw to go back to the scenes of the crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't help but keep linking it to the eternal kind of return to daddy or to his home country. I can completely understand that. But wanting to go back, wanting acceptance, or just... the ego, is it? That, no, I'm going to be recognised and I'm going to go and do whatever the hell I want in these places. Why would you go back? Are you just that?
God knows.
Egotistical, narcissistic, mad, clearly.
Mad, very mad. Much mad.
Mental. Mental it was. Oh, God. He feels like more of a... almost like a mafia boss rather than a cult leader. I mean, potato, potato, maybe, but that he's trying to run a business or he's trying to get recruits along who are relying on him and can fund his lifestyle. I suppose it is more of a cult leader, really, isn't it?
Yeah, because he's trying to build up those followers wherever he goes. But yeah. Obviously, for whatever reason, he can't stay in one place, which I think is probably you need if you're a cult leader. You need to have a base. You need to be relatively... stable in this is where you're going to control.
Yeah, he's got
but he is desperate to run around most of Asia, it would seem, from country and country to city to city. So that sort of rootlessness seems to be potentially his downfall in cult terms.
Yes. And also at the end of his life, where he could have just made money selling his disgusting story. And so did he admit in the end, when he was giving these interviews, did he admit to the murders?
He never sort of saying, yes, I killed them. He would talk about the victims and things that, yes, he knew them, he'd met them, this had happened, that happened, but never outright saying, yeah, I killed this person. But going as close to and skirting around as much as he could without saying, yes, I did it, I killed them all.
Wow. What drives someone to do that? It's a weird one. And I suppose... was he particularly wealthy in all these areas?
Well,
he lived well.
He certainly lived well. I don't think he was ludicrously, I mean, until the end when he was getting paid hundreds of thousands for his story and things. Then obviously he became stupidly wealthy when he was in traveling around Asia and things. I certainly think he was comfortable. I don't think he was living the life of a king at all or anything like that out there. He was certainly more comfortable.
And that's an intriguing element compared to some of the historic cases we've covered where we say greed, the greatest poison of them all. It doesn't seem like it is.
No.
It's more power.
It seems to be.
It's not really power, though, is it? Is it?
I don't know. But I don't think it doesn't seem to be like a need for recognition or anything like that. I don't know if it is
leadership.
Control. Being able to control people and being able to manipulate people.
Well, the control was taken away from him as a child.
That's very true.
Yeah, he didn't have control over his life. And then what do to have control? You break the law and you sort of break all the other imposed control upon you. And then,
And his ability to prove that he was better than the authorities who were chasing him. He was smarter than them. He was faster than them. He was able to anticipate what they were going to do. And he was able to get out of the country. He was able to move around and avoid capture. So he was smarter than them. He was in control of that situation. So
shades of Ted Bundy, really, isn't it? Which we must cover at some point. We are. Control, the greatest poison of them all? Not really. Control's probably a good thing in certain circumstances.
In certain circumstances, yeah.
Not just too much control. The lust for control, the greatest poison of them all. It's a new one, people. Well, what do you think of the great story there from Nick of the serpent? Do you know it? Have you seen the films? Have you watched the TV programs? Have you listened to the stories about this fascinating character? What do you think his motivations were? Do you think it was about trying to retain control? Do you think it was more mercenary than that or more monetary? Or was he just really horrible to people? Obviously, he had a lot of women who were following him around and he obviously abused them in certain ways. Yes, what do you think drives someone to do such things? And why are we so fascinated with them to the point where they're set free and we go, let's give you lots of money to make you famous? Is that right? Are we doing that right
now? I was just going to say that. Aren't we doing exactly the same thing?
We're not paying. We'd never pay a murderer for their story, I don't think.
No, we wouldn't do that.
I'd like to say I don't think.
We wouldn't do that. But there is a fascination for these things.
Yes, covering the story is one
thing. Which is why True Crime Podcast is the biggest category out there, of which we are very grateful to be a part of.
Exactly. We're very, very grateful you listen to us. We ain't paying any murderers for their stories. Other people will, and then we'll use that as source material.
Precisely.
Absolutely fine. Well, tell us what you think in the comments of any of the social media posts that you follow for this episode. Send us a DM. Talk about it amongst your friends over dinner this weekend and on a nice meal, not one that's poisoned. Please don't. Yes, share cocktail ideas. Share stories, share tales of your favourite true crime episodes, and tell them all about the Poisonous Cabinet and the wonderful work that we did covering this case. But most importantly, you must mix up a rattlesnake.
Absolutely, yes. Surprisingly nice. I am definitely going to try it with less sugar to see if it is a bit more bitey. I fancy something a bit more bitey, but it is delightfully pleasant as it is. So heartily recommend. And incredibly simple.
Yes.
Whiskey, sugar, lemon juice, absinthe if you have it. If you don't, not the end of the world. An egg white. Simple, simple, simple to make.
And tell us what you think of it. Do you think it works? Do you think it's absolutely delightful? Do you think it's missing something? We'd love to hear your thoughts. We'd love to hear about more of the cocktails that you're enjoying. So please keep sending us pictures, suggestions. Tag us in your photos on social media. DM us messages and pictures by all means. But please tag us in the pictures where you're enjoying them, because it means we can share your work with the world. And very importantly, please join us on Patreon if you want more episodes every single week and just want to banter with us. Thanks for listening, guys. Guys, we have been the people inside the Poisoner's Cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.